Usually when we talk about a wild animal at the zoo, there is this expectation of just like raw power.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you see
Yeah.
a lion, and even behind a few inches of glass, you can feel that primal energy.
Right. It is supposed to be majestic.
The undisputed king of the jungle, you
Yeah.
know, it commands a certain level of awe just by existing.
It really does. But then you look a little closer, and suddenly that majestic image just completely shatters.
Yeah, because you realize you are looking at a creature that is honestly just pacing.
Just pacing back and forth. It is trapped in this completely artificial environment, totally disconnected from what it was actually built to do.
It's tragic when you really stop and look at it.
It really is. So today on the Depth Dive, we are looking at Kent Wagner's latest sermon for our Harmony Christian Church family. It's called Lions and Fences.
And we are asking a pretty terrifying question based on that sermon. Are we doing the exact same thing in our own spiritual lives?
Yeah, so our goal for you guys listening today, especially as you get ready for your Connect groups, is to unpack Kent's wild geographical history lessons, define a very specific ancient Greek word, and figure out how we can tear down those artificial fences.
Because those fences are keeping us from our God-given purpose.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to really understand that pacing lion, we have to look at the story Ken opened with.
Oh my gosh, that story.
Right? Because he shared an experience from his teenage years that starts out absolutely hilarious, but it pivots into something surprisingly tragic.
I have to admit, that opening story completely caught me off guard.
Why is that?
Well, I just always expect a sermon to start with some, profound theological premise, and instead we get teenage Kent at the zoo with his buddies, trying desperately to look cool.
Yeah, he's standing in front of this massive 800-pound lion-like real-life Mufasa.
And he has this rare moment of vulnerability. He tries to sound deep and says to his friends, man, it's amazing that we can be so close to nature.
Which, knowing the brutal dynamics of teenage boy friendships, is essentially painting a giant target on your own back.
Oh, he knew it instantly. He realized he was about to be mocked mercilessly for being sentimental.
Oh.
Total panic. So, in a sheer panic to save face, he quickly tacks on the phrase and still throw rocks.
Which gets a huge laugh from his friends.
It does, but the lion apparently had impeccable comedic timing and zero tolerance for disrespect.
None at all. Because according to Kent, the lion was just lying there facing them, and the second he makes this joke about throwing rocks, the lion spreads its legs and unleashes this aggressive, high-pressure retaliation.
Urine right at the glass.
Right at the glass. The boys all have to scatter.
It is such a funny image, but Kent uses that ridiculous moment to point out a deeply poignant detail about that specific enclosure.
Yeah, because that lion wasn't just in a cage.
No, it was fenced in with the Humane Society literally on one side, meaning it was constantly hearing the squeaking and squealing of small animals.
And on the other side of the fence, a gazelle exhibit.
Just staring at a buffet it can never reach.
Exactly. And that is the core tragedy of the metaphor. I mean, think about the underlying mechanics of what makes a lion a lion.
Right, you have an apex predator. It is built for the hunt.
Its muscular structure, its instincts, its camouflage, everything is perfectly designed to stalk prey in the tall grass. But someone put a steel fence around it.
And because of that artificial barrier, the lion is completely robbed of its fundamental nature.
It cannot hunt the gazelles it stares at all day long. It cannot reach the prey it hears.
So, what is the psychological result of that?
It paces, it walks in circles, or it just sleeps 20 hours a day. It completely forgets its purpose.
When you really sit with that image, it hits incredibly close to home.
It really does.
Think about the modern Christian experience for so many of us here at Harmony. We show up on a Sunday, we sit in our comfortable rows, but deep down, there is this gnawing feeling that we are built for something more.
Like we're built for something fierce, something with actual stakes.
Yes, but we get trapped by these invisible, culturally constructed fences. We just settle for a safe, predictable routine.
We pace back and forth in our comfortable suburban lives, completely neutered of our spiritual power.
We just lose our roar.
We forget what we were built for because we've accepted the cage as normal.
Wow. Yeah, that's heavy.
But if you want to see what it looks like to break out of that enclosure, you have to look at the geographical realities of Jesus' ministry.
Okay, lay that out for us.
Because Jesus did not stay in safe, familiar territory. He deliberately walked his followers out of their cultural cages and crossed into profoundly hostile enemy territory to reveal what they were actually meant to do.
Now, I have to stop you there, because when it comes to the geography of the Bible, I am pretty clueless.
That's totally fair. Most of us are.
I mean, I have always just pictured Jesus walking around in nice rolling grassy hills in Jerusalem or floating around the Sea of Galilee. I never really thought of his travels as like a tactical military operation.
That is a very common misconception.
Yes.
And Ken gave us a brilliant way to visualize the reality of this using what he called the arm map.
Oh, yeah. This was so helpful.
Right. So if you are listening right now, just imagine your arm raised up in front of you. Your shoulder area represents the southern region, Jerusalem, and the Dead Sea.
Got it.
If you move up your arm to your elbow, that is the Sea of Galilee. Now, you are right. Jesus did spend the vast majority of his time around that elbow.
Because that was safe, familiar Jewish territory.
Exactly. He was surrounded by his own people. But for this specific moment, he leaves the elbow and travels all the way up to your hand.
And the hand in this visual is a place called Caesarea Philippi, which sits right at the base of Mount Hermon.
Yes. And the cultural shift from the elbow to the hand is staggering.
How so?
Well, Caesarea Philippi was named to honor Caesar. It was fiercely pagan. Racially, politically, and culturally, it was the absolute last place a respected Jewish rabbi should be taking a group of young Jewish disciples.
And towering over the city is Mount Hermon. Kent mentioned it's this massive 9,000-foot peak, snow-capped, even when he visited in the middle of July.
Just physically intimidating.
Right. But the physical intimidation of the mountain isn't even the craziest part. It is the supernatural lore attached to it.
Oh, this is where it gets really intense.
Yeah. Kent brought up this ancient Jewish text called the Book of Enoch.
Now, it is important to note that this text is not considered biblical scripture by the church.
Right, it's pseudepigrapha or something.
Exactly. Scholars categorize it as pseudepigrapha.
Yeah.
But it was incredibly popular and highly influential in shaping the cultural and spiritual imagination of the Jewish people during the first century.
And Kent described reading it as being somewhat akin to watching a modern supernatural horror movie.
That is a perfect description.
Because the lore in Enoch claims that Mount Hermon was the exact geographical location where 200 fallen angels, which the text calls watchers, descended from heaven.
And according to this tradition, they had relations with human women, creating a monstrous race of giants.
Which is just wild to think about.
It is. And when those giants eventually died, their spirits roamed the earth as the demons that plagued humanity.
So you have to put yourself in the sandals of Peter, James, or John. In their minds, based on the stories they grew up hearing, Mount Hermon wasn't just a big hill.
No, it was quite literally ground zero for demonic activity.
It was the fountainhead where cosmic evil first breached the human realm.
And the creepy factor doesn't stop with ancient Jewish lore. The Greeks and Romans had their own dark associations with this exact same spot.
Oh, yeah, the cave.
Right. At the base of the mountain, right where the headwaters of the Jordan River flow out, there is a massive, literal cave.
And the ancients actually carved shrines straight into the rock face next to it.
They worshiped gods like Pan, the half-man, half-goat deity of chaos and panic and Zeus.
They performed cultic rituals and sacrifices there. They quite literally refer to this cave as the gates of Hades or the gates of hell. So, okay, clarify this for me. Is Kent bringing up the Book of Enoch and the shrines to Pan just to give us some spooky trivia to keep us awake?
Not at all.
Or does this actually change the fundamental stakes of what Jesus is doing? Because, I mean, taking your disciples to a place where people sacrifice to goat gods seems like a terrible idea for a youth retreat.
What's fascinating here is that the location is the entire point. Jesus isn't taking them on a scenic hike. He is deliberately picking a fight on the enemy's home turf.
Wow.
By marching his disciples miles out of their way to Caesarea Philippi, to the very spot that humanity considers the absolute epicenter of demonic evil and pagan worship, he is staging a massive cosmic confrontation.
He is taking his followers to the literal gates of hell to make a declaration about who is truly in charge.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Jesus places his disciples in front of this terrifying pagan cliff face.
They are staring at the gaping maw of the gates of Hades surrounded by idols.
And he asks them the single most important question in human history.
Who do you say I am?
Exactly. And Peter steps up with what we now call the Great Confession. He looks at Jesus and says, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." We cannot gloss over the sheer political and physical danger of Peter speaking those specific words in that specific location.
Oh, it was a huge risk.
Right. To call Jesus the Messiah, which means the anointed king, while standing in a city named after Caesar Augustus and standing in front of shrines dedicated to the Roman pantheon is pure, unadulterated treason.
If a Roman soldier hears you say that, it is an immediate death sentence.
But Jesus doesn't shush him. Jesus' response is incredible. He plays on Peter's birth name, Simon.
Yeah, the wordplay here is so important.
He changes his name to Peter, which in the original Greek is Petros, and Petros translates to a small stone or a little pebble.
But then Jesus shifts his vocabulary.
Right, he says, and on this rock, using an entirely different Greek word, Petra.
Which means a massive, immovable, foundational boulder.
Exactly. He says, on this boulder, I will build my church.
There's a significant historical divergence in how that wordplay is interpreted, which Kent touched on.
Yeah, how does that break down?
Well, the Catholic interpretation has historically viewed Peter himself as that massive boulder upon which the institutional church is built.
Okay, sure.
But Kent's view, which aligns with historical Protestant theology, points out the distinction between the pebble and the boulder. In this view, the massive boulder isn't Peter the flawed man.
The boulder is the confession Peter just made.
Right. The truth that Jesus is the true king, the Son of the living God, that absolute truth is the bedrock foundation.
And then Jesus looks directly at that literal cave, the dark, echoing gates of Hades right behind them, and he promises that those gates will not overcome his church.
It is this epic cinematic moment of defiance.
It really is. But it all hinges on a word that Jesus introduces here for the very first time, because if the gates of hell cannot stop the church, we desperately need to understand what that word actually means.
Because for generations, we have largely been getting the definition wrong.
We really have.
The word translated as church in our English Bibles is the Greek word ekklesia.
Break the mechanics of that word down for us, because Kent said understanding this one Greek word completely shifted his paradigm for what we are doing every week.
Ekklesia is a compound word. It was made up of two parts. First, you have ek, which means out of.
Okay.
And then kaleo, which means to call or to summon.
So called out.
Exactly. Mm. So when Jesus says he is going to build his church, he is not talking about constructing a building with a steeple and stained glass.
Right.
He is saying, I will build my called out ones. The church is not a place you go to. It is a people summoned out of the world for a specific militant purpose.
Look, I have to admit, hearing the actual definition of ecclesia makes me cringe at my own vocabulary.
Oh, I think we all feel that.
I am completely guilty of using phrases like, oh, I'm going to church today, or talking about church shopping when someone moves to a new city.
Right, as if you're comparing the produce section at two different grocery stores.
Exactly. But when you realize the church is the called out ones, you realize how those cultural consumer phrases completely neuter our spiritual power.
You can't go to the called out ones.
You are the called out ones.
The implications of that shift everything about how we view our gatherings.
Mm-hmm.
Kent connected this beautifully to a theological concept found later in the book of Ephesians.
Oh, a seal, right.
Yes. God places a seal, a literal deposit of the Holy Spirit, inside each individual believer. Think of an ancient wax seal pressed onto a royal decree, marking it as the undeniable property of the king.
So when we gather together as a church on a Sunday morning, or when we sit in a living room for a Connect group on a Wednesday night, we aren't just filing into a room to watch a performance or hear a lecture.
No, we are bumping shoulders with other spirit carriers.
Bumping shoulders with spirit carriers. I love that.
And this highlights a crucial mechanism of spiritual growth. It is why simply consuming Christian content, as wonderful as podcasts, books, or online services can be, can never, ever replace the physical gathering of the ecclesia.
Because it's just not the same.
It isn't. You can listen to 1,000 brilliant sermons on your commute, but it will never replicate the spiritual dynamic of being in a physical room.
Yeah.
Making eye contact with another human being who is carrying a deposit of the living God inside them.
Content cannot replace the catalytic power of community.
Exactly.
It is the difference between looking at a high-definition photograph of a campfire and actually standing next to a real fire to get warm.
That's a great way to put it.
But so many of us settle for the photograph. We settle for the safe, comfortable content because it doesn't require anything of us.
Which brings us perfectly to the jarring story Kent shared about the college professor.
Oh man, that story is incredibly sobering.
It really is.
So this was a professor who suffered a medical emergency and fell into a coma for a prolonged period. But when he finally emerged, he revealed something terrifying.
What did he say?
He said that the entire time his body was unresponsive, his mind was completely awake.
Yeah.
He could hear everything happening around him. He heard the doctors talking. He heard his family reading to him. He processed all the information in the room, but he was completely paralyzed.
He couldn't wake his body up?
No, he couldn't even move a finger to squeeze his wife's hand.
Kent used that physical paralysis as a direct metaphor for the modern Christian life, and honestly, it fits perfectly.
Sadly, it really does.
So many of us are sleepwalking through our days, completely numb, trapped in a spiritual coma. We know the theology, we hear the sermons, but we are paralyzed.
We just chase the suburban dream.
Right. We carefully curate a flawless aesthetic on our social media. We obsess over making sure our lawns look better than the neighbors. But we are completely blind to the massive cosmic spiritual reality buzzing all around us.
We are the pacing lion in the zoo.
Exactly. We're just lying there in our comfortable enclosure, totally oblivious to the fierce reality we were made for.
To snap us out of that self-induced coma, Kent brought in a truly haunting philosophical concept from C.S. Lewis.
From his famous sermon, The Weight of Glory.
Right. Lewis wrote that there are no ordinary people. You have never met a mere mortal.
I have heard that quote before, but framing it within this discussion about the gates of hell, it gave me absolute chills.
Unpack what Lewis actually means by that.
Well, Lewis is pointing out a fundamental flaw in human perception.
Mm-hmm.
We look at the people around us, the barista handing us coffee, the coworker complaining in the break room, our spouse, our kids, the person aggressively cutting us off in traffic.
And we just see them as temporary, ordinary fixtures in our day.
Right. But Lewis argues that every single person you lock eyes with is an immortal being heading toward one of two eternal destinations.
Okay.
They're either on a trajectory to become a magnificent, glorious creature that if you saw them in their final state right now, you would be strongly tempted to fall down and worship them.
Wow.
Or they're heading toward becoming a nightmare of corruption, horror, and despair.
I had never considered it that way. It completely shatters the illusion of small talk.
It really does.
It means that the stakes of our everyday, seemingly mundane interactions are infinitely higher than we realize.
If we connect this to the bigger picture that Kent is weaving, it means our God-given purpose, the fierce nature we were built for, is fundamentally tied to this reality.
In the moment we wake up.
Yes. In our friendships, our work, our parenting, our hobbies, we are actively helping each other toward one of those two eternal destinations.
That is the true purpose of the lion.
It is not to pace safely in a cage. It is to step into the dangerous, thrilling reality that we are the ecclesia.
We are the called out ones, carrying the spirit of a living God.
Commissioned to actively push back the gates of hell in the lives of the immortal beings all around us.
Man, and that brings this entire deep dive right down into your living room for your Connect group this week.
Absolutely.
When you get together with your group, remember the lesson of Caesarea Philippi? Church is not about Kent's preaching ability. It is not about how perfectly the worship band played on Sunday morning. If we make our faith about a charismatic person or a polished production, we are just building another artificial fence.
And we neuter the power of God's called out people.
You are the ecclesia.
You are the ones who have been summoned out of the world.
So as you head into your Connect group tonight, we want to leave you with one final provocative thought to chew on.
Something to maybe even discuss as a group before you crack open the study guide.
If the church isn't a building, but a gathering of the called out ones carrying the literal seal of the Holy Spirit, well, what does that make your Connect group living room?
Are you just gathering to have some snacks, complain about the weather, and make small talk?
Just pacing back and forth in a comfortable little cage.
Or by bumping shoulders with other spirit carriers, are you actually assembling a militant outpost right at the very gates of Hades?
And if you truly are an outpost in enemy territory, what is the specific gate in your own neighborhood, your workplace, or your extended family that you are being called to push back against this week?